supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Hello and welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm, I'm clearly not Mike McGrath. I'm the much less booming voice of Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, here to guest host a very special show in which we'll listen back to some of the most interesting interviews Mike has conducted over the past couple of years on fascinating topics like fruit trees, rain gardens, poison ivy, mosquitoes, and more, all selected to help you get through this growing season unbit, unrashed, unflooded, and, well, fruited. Joining me now to help out with this very special edition of You Bet Your Garden is ace production assistant Marissa Nicosia. Hi, Marissa.
Hi, Alexis. I'm happy to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you here. But first up, we'll hear the always fruitful wisdom of Mike's good friend and frequent guest, Lee Reich, our most trusted fruit expert. This time out, Mike asked Lee to name the easiest fruits for beginners, because as Mike often warns, growing your own fruit can be a lot harder than you think. Let's take a listen.
Dr. Lee Reich, author, just made him blush, author of many books, including The Pruning Book, a very shy title there, Landscaping with Fruit, and his newest book, Grow Fruit Naturally. You hear Lee's name mentioned a lot on the show when we have to reference fruit growing or pruning. I take everything out of his books. I just cheat. They're my little cheat sheets. Lee, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden.
Good to be here, Mike.
We've had you on about Grow Fruit Naturally. We've had you on about the pruning book. I thought it would be interesting for you and I to talk about what people who want to grow fruit should start with and to kind of get their expectations in order. Because I get so many phone calls from people who, like, plant an apple tree and think it's going to take care of itself, or they plant like 8 grapevines and that was the sum total of their investment. They planted them. Why aren't things working out? My feeling is there's things you can do that with, like raspberries and blackberries, that if you just stay out of their way, they're going to give you nice fruit if you just pay attention and pick it. Do you think those are the easiest things for people to get started with?
I think that they are among the easiest, but I think it's a good point that you make, that people think, often when people think about planting fruit, the first thing they think about is planting apples, something about apples equal fruit. And the point that I try and make in my book is that a very important part of growing fruit naturally is choosing a fruit that is easy to grow where you live. East of the Rocky Mountains, pretty much the hardest fruits to grow are probably apples, cherries, plums, apricots, nectarines. Often when I say that, people say, well, so what can I grow? That seems like all the fruits. So, and there's so many other fruits you can grow. And if somebody wants a pretty standard tree fruit, what I would recommend is pears.
That seems to me to be the universal agreement, that if you want to get started with fruits.
Fruit trees.
Right.
Standard fruit trees.
Standard fruit trees, that pears do the best with the least care.
Yeah. And you know, and you have so many things to choose from with pears. First of all, you have Asian pears and you have European pears.
Well, talk about that.
Well, Asian pears are the ones, they're usually but not always round, and they have a different texture and flavor than European pears. They're a different species. And they have what's called a cracking texture, where they're sort of crisp, but when you bite into them, they explode with this sweet juice in your mouth. So they're quite good, very easy to grow, very decorative too.
Pears to me seem to be almost apple-like, more like apples than peaches or other tree fruits.
Yeah, they're very similar, but for some reason they just don't have the same pest problems or as severe pest problems. They do have some pest problems, but a pear is something you can choose a variety and you can plant it, you prune it, and pruning isn't that difficult, and you will get pears.
And they keep.
And they keep, right? They keep just like apples. You can keep. There are pears that will keep into, you know, through winter.
Whereby, with peaches, you got to be out there every day.
Right.
I find myself harvesting the peaches always a little early because everything wants to claim them. Squirrels, right. Stink bugs, yeah, brown rot.
Don't get me started on squirrels.
Don't get me started on stink bugs. Yeah. I wanted to talk to you a little bit today about grapes because I've never grown grapes, and I feel like this is a great lack of knowledge. I always feel more comfortable talking about stuff that I've grown, preferably grown for years and years. And I know the answers with grapes, but it's so theoretical. And this seems to be, along with apples, the thing that people put in the ground and then think it's going to take care of itself. And do grapes need more pruning than peaches, or is this a tie for first place?
Well, I would say it's a tie for first place. And grapes are much easier to grow than apples. I mean, there's a lot of the two things with grapes for success are choosing an appropriate variety for the climate and the pest problems. And there are 5,000 varieties of grapes.
You know, I often tell people, because people want to prune ornamentals too much. They just think everything needs to be pruned. And you have to remind them that in nature, not a lot of stuff gets pruned except by deer or rabbits or that kind of thing. But there are some plants that really don't respond well unless they're pruned every year. And I think grapes would be the poster child, right?
Right. They grow fine. I mean, you look in the woods, they grow fine. But you do not get good grapes. You do not get grapes that are, you know, pretty disease-free. And you don't get grapes that are within reach.
Right. And I always tell people, and I don't know if this goes across the board for grapes, but one of my lines is when the vine is putting on its fruit and its leaves, you need to be thinning both of them. Both the leaves and to keep air circulation and the fruit clusters, as with apples and peaches, so that what's left has the potential to develop into real market quality
fruit. Right. That has something to do with the variety, how much thinning you need. But a lot of the thinning actually is done when you prune them earlier because that removes potential leaves. But then you're right. Then sometimes, depending on how it's trained or the variety or the season, you might want to thin out some branches, leaves, or fruit clusters just to get better air circulation and more energy going to fewer fruits.
So we would urge people to grow raspberries and blackberries, warning them that these are cane fruits that need room to spread, and they will, if you're lucky, spread aggressively.
And they need to be pruned every year.
Well, you know, I don't really prune my raspberries. I'll tell you what I do. I have a heritage raspberries mostly. So the first year, the cane grows really long and then fruits on the end. And at the end of the season, I'll just go out and clip off, you know, the old areas where the fruit was. Just a tiny bit, maybe 6 inches. And then I'll leave that cane alone over winter because I know it's going to fruit again.
Yeah.
In the late spring. And then by the time it almost seems like you pick the last fruit, the cane can't wait to die, that cane. It's right. Like the leaves are all yellow. It's calling the suicide prevention hotline. And within a month, you don't even have to prune it. You just push it to the side and it snaps off. They seem to have this.
You do get rid of them one way or another.
One way or another, I do get rid of them.
Yeah, that's the important thing. The other thing, actually, with cane fruits is not to let them spread in all directions or you have a bramble patch. You want to keep, like, ideally, a row maybe a foot wide so you get a lot of light and air. Let's talk about another common fruit that's very easy to grow, that if I was going to grow just one fruit, this would be it. Ready?
The black mulberry.
No.
Okay.
Blueberries.
Yes.
Beautiful plants year-round. Tastes great. They're super healthful, and you can choose varieties. My blueberry harvest, this is my best fruit. My blueberry harvest starts in mid-June and goes into September.
Because you have an early, a mid, and a late variety.
Well, early, mid, and late varieties.
You're right.
So it's like the whole season. And you know, with good, if you take care of the soil correctly, do everything correctly, you get enormous yields. I was just computing. We keep careful records of yields,
yeah,
just so I can brag.
Mm-hmm.
So my blueberries so far this year have averaged about 11 quarts per bush.
That's very good. Yeah. And again, I mean, it is low-hanging fruit, Lee. They are so easy to grow. They make you look good when you know.
And low-hanging, you don't need a ladder.
Exactly.
And the other thing I have to say, the other fruit that I'm not that crazy over is strawberries.
Really?
Just because I think they taste okay, and it's nice that they're early, but I don't like talking about low-hanging. I do not like to crawl for my fruit.
I'll make a liar out of you, because I know we both have a common favorite fruit. which is the alpine strawberry.
Right. I do like those.
The little clumping strawberries.
But I grow them in a pot on a wall next to my walkway so I don't have to crawl for
yes,
them.
No. All my alpines are in pots. And all I do when winter comes is I push the pots up against the side of the
right.
house. Some years I cover them with shredded leaves. Some years I don't. It just seems if you pay some attention to them,
right.
they're happy.
And if you pay no attention, they're not that unhappy.
All right. All right. Lee Reich, ladies and gentlemen, if you need pruning advice, read his book called The Pruning Book. If you want to read about all the underappreciated fruits, Lee, do you see what I have here?
Uh-huh.
I brought it in. It's a heavy book, you know. Got to give me some credit here. If you want to read his early tome about, but of course it's all been revised and
well, that is the revision.
This is the revision, Uncommon Fruits for Every Garden. This is the book where I learned about you. And his two newest books are Landscaping with Fruit, which is very interesting, again, because you do rate the attractiveness, the appeal of it. And I think everybody, you know, we're all trying to grow more in smaller spaces. So it's not just enough to get a nice edible harvest, depending on how visible you are. You really do need attractive-looking plants.
Right.
And I think in that book you really show how to achieve that. And your newest book is Grow Fruit Naturally, because when Lee talks about spraying or other things, he's not talking about spraying toxins. He's talking about spraying cool, organic, and sustainable stuff.
Or ideally spraying nothing. That's the ideal.
Yeah, or water or something like
that.
Or
nothing.
Yeah. Lee Reich, author of many books on fruit, an excellent book on pruning. Lee, always a pleasure to speak with
Thanks.
You.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Yeah, Lee Reich is certainly one of a kind. Anyway, it's time for us to take a little break, but don't you go away because we'll be right back with rooftops, rain gardens, mosquito prevention, and I'm Alexis Landis.
And I'm Marissa Nicosia.
And we're guest hosting a very special edition of You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for WHYY's You Bet Your Garden is made possible by Burpee. Burpee is committed to providing all things needed for planting and growing your garden. Seeds, plants, supplies, videos, and more are online at burpee.com. And Star Roses and Plants, the company that introduced the Knockout family of roses. Drift roses are low-maintenance, disease-resistant, and hardy to zone 4, a cross between full-size ground cover roses and miniature roses that bloom all season. More at starrosesandplants.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Alexis Landis, pretending to be Mike McGrath today as we take you through some of our favorite interviews to give you tips, tricks, and new ideas for this year's growing season. In this segment, we'll talk about different approaches to gardens. Sometimes you might not have ground space and you need to think up a different way to garden. I'll let our production assistant, Marissa Nicosia, set up our first interview about rooftop gardening.
Thanks, Alexis. Mike spoke with Lauren Mandel, who is a professional designer of rooftops rooftop gardens, and she gives us lots of ideas on how to plan one of these rooftop gardens, but also some of the many pitfalls to watch out for. Let's listen.
It is time to welcome our special guest, Lauren Mandel, the author of Eat Up, the Inside Scoop on Rooftop Agriculture. Lauren holds a Master of Landscape Architecture from the University of Pennsylvania and a Bachelor of Arts in Environmental Science. She is a Project Manager and Rooftop Agriculture Specialist at Roof Meadow, where she designs green roofs and oversees rooftop agriculture projects throughout North America. Lauren, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Now, I have to say that an increasing amount of my emails are people asking about growing on rooftops. And I will tell you that the first, well, there's like eight first things I ask them because, you know, they bought a house or something and they don't have any room to grow outside, or people keep stealing the vegetables from their little yard and they want to use their roof. And the first thing I ask them is, can you get access to the roof? Have you thought about how you're going to get soil and water up to the roof? And do you think it's structurally sound? Those are the starting points, right, for just a human who wants to do this, to have their own garden up high.
Absolutely. Those are some of the very first things that you want to think about before climbing up to your own roof and getting started. And the load capacity issue in particular, so making sure that your roof is strong enough to support the weight of the soil, the plants, and the water that's going to be up there, is very important. And it's best to speak with a professional about that.
So in your work, you always have a structural engineer on a rope nearby, right?
That's correct. Always on every project before we get started.
One thing people misunderstand, I mean, even outdoors on a patio, if you're paying attention, a medium-sized container after a couple days of heavy rain is darned heavy. So it's not just the stuff you're hauling up to the roof. It's that stuff when it's totally saturated with water, when it can weigh, what, 3, 4, 5 more times?
Right, exactly. It can get very heavy, and you don't want to mess around, especially when it's your own roof.
Yeah, right. A big container right in the center of an ill-planned
right.
roof.
And the structural engineer will help you not only guide you to how much weight you can put on the roof, but he or she can also tell you where exactly that weight can go.
In Philadelphia, first of all, flat roof is highly desirable. And you see in Center City, a lot of people build decks on their roof. Now, once that deck is built, I think you almost have a free pass on growing a fair amount of stuff on the deck itself, because the deck has already been hopefully constructed to distribute weight.
Exactly. It does distribute the weight. And oftentimes when people are interested in building a deck on top of the roof, they will speak with an architect who will speak with a structural engineer. So if the architect knows in advance what you're planning to do, then your options are very flexible.
And obviously, if somebody has a rooftop deck, they got a way to get up to it.
Right, exactly. And it's important to look into the building codes that are specific to your city. And so different cities will actually tell you the ways in which they want you to get up to the roof safely. The best thing to do is to find out what's legal, especially if you're going to be going up regularly. And oftentimes what that requires is a staircase that goes all the way up to the roof through something called a head house.
What's a head house?
A head house, which is also called a pilot house, is basically a staircase that extends all the way up to the roof. And there's a door at the top and a small vestibule that provides access to the roof from the downstairs. In some of the larger buildings, they'll even have an elevator, for a freight elevator, for example, that goes all the way up to the roof. And that's really useful when you're moving large quantities of soil and compost and vegetables around.
And I will tell you that back in the 90s, I actually designed a rooftop garden for Rodale. Rodale's New York headquarters was across the street from a homeless shelter that had been built in like this Ghostbusters building that was all steel frame, that was just the most solid building you've ever seen. And there was a stairway right up to the roof. And I went up there with a structural engineer, and we decided to just line the entire outside of the roof, inside, so to speak, but the outside corners, all the entire area, with growing boxes about 3 feet up in the air. You know, made sure they had drainage, had like lanes underneath to carry the drainage water down the same way of rainwater on the roof. And boy, did they kick growing herbs and cucumbers and salad greens and everything up there.
Yeah, and that's a really smart approach because oftentimes the strongest part of a roof is the perimeter. So putting your boxes there is a good place to start, so long as it's okay with the structural engineer. So one thing that I tell my clients is that you have to keep in mind how much weight you're adding over time. So you have to think about your compost strategy. You have to think about what your farm's going to weigh a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, to make sure that you're not exceeding the load capacity.
Right. I'm really thinking that a roof that is decked out is just so much easier to do this on than a roof that has nothing done. And maybe the first step in actually making a rooftop the family garden would be to deck it out first.
Yeah, and one of the other benefits that we didn't mention about a deck is the fact that you can add a railing around the perimeter of the deck. And this is very useful if you want to comply with local building codes.
And in terms of not falling to your doom.
And also, you want to keep the kids on the roof. You really don't want them falling over the side, walking onto your neighbor's roof, anything like that. So having a railing that's to regulation height is really critical. And you can even use your railing for climbers.
So, first of all, you want to make sure it's structurally sound, easy to walk on, easy to access. Then you've got to figure out not only the weight, because hopefully in the construction process, the weight has all been accounted for, but you got to haul this stuff up there. I love the idea as I get older of tabletop gardening, you know, of big boxy containers sitting up on like picnic tables or supported by heavy stands so that you're not bending over. Especially for things like salad greens and herbs, it makes so much more sense. But you have to haul up all the material.
That's a great solution. And something that we also want to think about is irrigation. So how are you watering these plants up there? How are you getting water up to the roof?
If you got a big roof, and if you're putting a big deck on it, and you want to have big plants, would you actually suggest hiring a plumber to run a pipe up through your roof?
Oh, I would. And that's actually relatively inexpensive relative to some other improvements that you might need. So any kind of structural reinforcement will cost a lot of money. Sometimes building the deck itself can be quite expensive. But just adding a place for water access on the roof is pretty inexpensive.
Lauren Mandel is the author of Eat Up, the Inside Scoop on Rooftop Agriculture. Before you start dragging the planters up through your windows and trying to get out onto your roof, read Lauren's book. Know what you're doing. It is a great amount of unused space. There is so much rooftop space in our urban areas where people could be growing their own food and food for others. But you need to know what you're doing. Lauren, you've written a great book to help people understand those needs.
Thank you so much.
Well, that was great. And I never thought there was so much to think about when trying to design a garden several stories high, especially taking the water up there. Now, Marissa, you live in a beautiful section of Philadelphia, West Philadelphia, and they're known for their gardens. But I bet there's a lot of rooftop gardens up there.
There are a lot of rooftop gardens, but there are also a lot of very old Victorian houses in the neighborhood. So people have to be very careful that they don't overweigh those old roofs to grow their beautiful flowers and produce up in the air.
Wow, I would not want water leaking through my old Victorian roof, that's for sure. Our next interview takes us back down to earth, where we think about ways to deal with a wet landscape. Sometimes it's easier just to lean into it and find plants that like having their feet wet. Here's author Lynn Steiner to take us through it.
All right. As promised, it is time to welcome our guest, Lynn Steiner, who is the co-author of Rain Gardens, Sustainable Landscaping for a Beautiful Yard and a Healthy World. Lynn, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I don't have to tell you that rain gardens is the new buzzword in gardening. It's kind of replaced what heirlooms were 6 or 7 years ago. The world is greatly abuzz with talk of rain gardens, but I fear that people may misunderstand. I feel that sometimes I may misrepresent what a rain garden truly is. Most of the time I talk about them, they are as a proposed solution to a yard that does not drain well. But as I go through your book, it's almost like you're advocating them just for the sheer joy of their gardenness.
Well, that certainly is a positive aspect to having rain gardens. We do advocate planting them with native plants. And so we're, in addition to retaining water, we're creating a habitat garden that welcomes insects, butterflies, birds, and that sort of thing. So it does do more than just retain water.
Well, as we go back to the early days of organic gardening, one of the first tenets after feeding your soil was inviting life into your garden. And, of course, the limiting factor in many American gardens in summertime is water. So if rain gardens really do help solve a problem of excessive wetness, they solve the second problem of lack of water for wildlife, right?
Well, yes, they do for a while. But remember that rain gardens, when properly designed, do not hold water for ideally more than 24 hours. Sometimes maybe 2 or 3 days if we have a really heavy rain. But ideally, they're supposed to hold the water for less than 24 hours and then allow it to drain into the soil.
So one of the big benefits to the environment of rain gardens, and I've seen these things in all different configurations, is simply to slow down this massive torrent of water that happens after a big rainfall.
Yes, because anything that is in the water that washes down your driveway or washes off your roof through your downspouts and goes into the storm drains, anything that's in there like fertilizer residue or pet waste or anything like that will go directly into the water source, the river, the stream, the pond that the storm drain is entering into. And we don't want that. We want to hold the water on site, on the homeowner's property, and allow it to soak back into the soil, replenish the aquifer there, so you're providing water to deep-rooted trees and shrubs, and keep it on site rather than have it wash away.
Now, a lot of the interest in rain gardens comes from people who have drainage problems, the vast majority of whom will email me or call asking what they can plant that will drain their backyard. How much of a help can a rain garden be in these kinds of situations?
Well, a rain garden, here again, really isn't a garden that is holding plants that like these wet, swampy type conditions. That would be more of a bog garden or wetland garden. The plants that will do well in a rain garden are able to tolerate water around their roots for, like I said, a day or two, but then the water drains away and we actually could go a couple weeks without more rain. So then they have to be able to tolerate the drought conditions also. If they actually have a place in their yard where the water is collecting and standing like that and staying around for a long enough time that they're worried about the plant being able to survive it, they're more looking at a heavy soil that really should be improved and replaced before you would put a rain garden into that site.
So you tell me, from writing this book, from your experience working with landscapes, making them more sustainable, making them a better place for native plants, what do you see the benefits for a homeowner?
The benefits for the homeowner would be to replenish their aquifer, you know, for their deep-rooted trees and shrubs, to create a habitat garden where they are encouraging beneficial insects and providing bird food and such. More of the benefits of a rain garden come farther on down the line to the community and, in turn, to the entire world. The main reason that I like to encourage people to put in rain gardens is to think about keeping our waterways healthy.
And I think people who have seen demonstration rain gardens are used to seeing, you know, concentric circles, so to speak. You know, maybe a tiny pond or an area in the center where plants can stay submerged for longer periods of time, and then another margin of plants that can go either way, and then plants on the outside that make it look drier. But the diversity I see in your book is much greater than that.
Yes. Being a native and plant enthusiast, like I am, we really put a lot of emphasis on giving readers a wide choice of plants to choose from so they can create a beautiful garden that really doesn't have to look any different than any other type of garden. A rain garden, to the untrained eye, should look just like any other native plant garden. So,
and the diversity of plants, your love of native plants clearly comes through, because you've got 50 pages in the back of this book of suggested plants for the rain garden, and we've got every shape, size, color, bloom time that anyone could possibly hope for. And again, I'm the plants I'm familiar with here, which is most of them, all of them are going to bring in beautiful butterflies and native pollinators, maybe even the occasional hummingbird, a lot of life in a rain garden.
Yes, we really put an emphasis on that. For every plant that we list, we give some of the wildlife that it will attract, some of the butterflies, the birds and such like that. I also want to make sure your listeners know that a rain garden doesn't just have to be perennials. It can also include shrubs and trees and ferns and ground covers. And there really is a great diversity of plants that you can use in a rain garden. So you can really have fun planting this garden. Functional, yet beautiful.
All right. We've been talking with Lynn Steiner, who is a co-author of the brand new book called Rain Gardens, Sustainable Landscaping for a Beautiful Yard and a Healthy World. It is published by Voyager Press, and we'll put a link to it up on our website the week we air this interview. Lynn, thanks very much for being on You Bet Your Garden.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Well, Marissa, did you ever think of using all those different plants to plant a rain garden?
There are so many possibilities, and it sounds like anyone could do a rain garden.
Absolutely. Well, it's time for us to take a little break, but don't go away just yet. We'll be back with more of our favorite interviews, including Mike's patented poison ivy removal method and ways to get rid of mosquitoes. I'm Alexis Landis.
And I'm Marissa Nicosia.
Guest hosting You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for WHYY's You Bet Your Garden is made possible by Burpee. Burpee is committed to providing all things needed for planting and growing your garden. Seeds, plants, supplies, videos, and more are online at burpee.com. And Star Roses and Plants, the company that introduced the Knockout family of roses. Drift roses are low-maintenance, disease-resistant, and hardy to zone 4, a cross between full-size ground cover roses and miniature roses that bloom all season. More at starrosesandplants.com.
Thank you.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. And we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens, as Mike McGrath would say. I'm Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, guest hosting and playing make-believe today as I pretend to be our host, Mike McGrath, and take you through some of our most interesting interviews in recent years to get your season off to a great start. Playing right along with me is our production assistant, Marissa Nicosia. Our last segment might make you a little itchy, though. We will talk about poison ivy and ways to protect yourself and mosquito prevention. But before you get parasitosis, Marissa set up our first interview.
Well, Alexis, Mike spoke with poison ivy expert Umar Mica. He has been a groundskeeper at the Philadelphia Zoo for over 40 years, and he knows everything about poison ivy. We learn how to protect ourselves and ways to remove it. Let's listen.
Now it's time for our special guest, poison ivy expert Umar Mica. Umar, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. Great to be here.
Now, the oil that all these plants have in common, we call them poison. But actually, the oil is an allergen, but it is the only known allergen that the majority of the population reacts to. But that also means some people aren't affected. Are you one of them?
No, I get poison ivy, and I have to protect myself when I'm removing it.
Okay. Talk a little bit about the connection between birds and poison ivy, because people find this fascinating that the birds don't get poison ivy internally.
Birds and people are a lot alike. Birds like shiny things just like people. People like shiny Mercedes-Benz. Birds like shiny seeds. They both eat them. Nobody eats a Mercedes, but the birds eat those seeds. And then they'll come in the winter after they eat the seeds, and they want to see what you're doing in your house. They'll sit on your deck. They'll look in your window. They want to see what your air conditioner is and spinning. And all those places that are shiny and spinning in your house are where birds are going to come. They'll defecate the seeds out. The poison ivy starts right there.
Which explains why so much poison ivy is found growing next to or up the sides of trees, because the birds were clearly roosting in a branch of that tree when they let go.
That's right.
Most people have never seen the berries, though. Are they what are called insignificant in the horticultural world, or do the birds just love them so much they gobble them up in the fall as soon as they appear?
Oh, from about October through the end of February, the birds, first the migrating birds and then the overwintering birds, are focused on those seeds. They're very important to them. Not only are they a food source to them, they're a pharmaceutical to them. And they will focus on them until the meteorological spring starts. When that starts, they could care less about poison ivy. Even if they're on the plant, they won't touch them anymore.
Poison ivy is bird medicine.
That's correct.
How?
It is a anesthetizing agent for them. They're tremendous athletes. They have to move. During the night, they fly. During the day, they sit down and roost. They have to eat a lot. They have to be able to pass all those things out and quickly move on to the next. The poison ivy berries are physiologically and also packaged by their shape in that way to do that job for the birds.
So it's probably not only possible but very common that a poison ivy plant that grows in my backyard could have come from a state further north if a bird was on a real tear.
That's right. The subspecies that we are dealing with here in Philadelphia is starting up in northern New Hampshire and going all the way down to Guatemala. It's the same subspecies.
Let's talk about removal. What I always recommend is, first of all, if you are overly sensitive, that you should go get ivy block, the clay that you put on your skin to protect yourself. And then what I suggest is, once you have identified the plant, you soak the soil with water. And then rather than use gloves or anything that's going to get the oil on your skin and transfer it, you use heavy shopping bags from the mall. Pull the plant. Once you get the root out of the soaking wet soil, wrap the bags around the plant, throw that into another bag or a trash can, then start with fresh bags. Because my concern is anything you use is going to pick up the oil, then you're going to get oil off those gloves, off those pruners, you know, forever.
Exactly right, Mike. That's beautiful and exactly the correct advice.
But you don't go around with plastic bags because you actually have a poison ivy removal service. Am I correct?
That's right. But it's the same idea. I protect myself with protective clothing and I have what works for me.
Now, you have a website, which is a great name. I often wonder how people snag these when the domain names were up for grabs. Your website is IDon'tWantPoisonIvy.com. You know, that's kind of right down to the point. And you do poison ivy removal. In the minute or two we have left, what do you want to tell a homeowner who sees poison ivy in their backyard or thinks they have poison ivy? Because there's so much bad information out there. Give your advice. You've heard mine.
If you can recognize the plant, then you can stay away from it and make your best decision of whether you feel safe using Mike's recommendations to pull it out or whether you think that it's beyond you and you need some help in pulling it out. That help can come from a lot of different places. The main thing is the identification and to go about getting this invader out of your yard without fear. So take the time that you need to look at the advice, to feel in yourself that that advice is right, and then make steps cautiously because we don't want you ending up in the emergency room.
It is the only medical emergency in dermatology when people are overcome by poison ivy. One thing we've forgotten to say that I think is so important because people will go to a store and they'll see an herbicide that says poison ivy killer. That part is true. You can spray this noxious chemical on the plant and the plant will die, but the oil is still there and the oil's allergenic. And how many people have gotten poison ivy from pulling out a dead plant that they thought had been rendered harmless?
That's very true. And really, herbicide is not a good solution for a poison ivy problem. To understand what the problem is, to look at it and to make an informed decision is a much better choice.
You know, I often recommend a flame weeder for driveway weeds and circumstances. And I know reading the medical literature that people have literally died inhaling poison ivy smoke. Is there any way to stress how important it is not to burn this plant? For instance, doesn't it get burned accidentally a lot when it's adhered to a piece of firewood?
That's true. If it gets burnt, the problem is that the combustibility, the combustion temperature that it takes to burn the wood is below the combustion that it takes to dissolve the resin. And so the resin that is still allergenic is carried on the particles of smoke or particles of soot. That's what's breathed in and causes a real problem.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, and that's one. I mean, there's a lot of reasons firefighters who fight forest fires have respirators, but that's a big one. Poison ivy on the inside of your lungs. Again, I've read the medical literature. It's horrendous. I mean, you're dying from the inside out.
Yeah, there's no choice but steroids at that point.
So be careful if you're having a bonfire or you're burning weeds. Always make sure that that plant never gets torched. All right. Our guest has been Umar Micah. His website is IDon'tWantPoisonIvy.com. And we'll put up a link to more information about Umar at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Umar, thanks very much for being on You Bet Your Garden, and keep up the good fight against PI.
Thanks, Mike. I really appreciate you having me here. Thank you.
And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499.
You know, I think people always think hot water is the way to go, but really cool water helps remove that uracil oil. I never knew that before. Well, Marissa, one of the biggest annoyances beside poison ivy in the summer for me is mosquitoes. Our good friend Howard Garrett, a.k.a. the Dirt Doctor, talked to Mike about some great ways to reduce the populations of mosquitoes on your property. Let's see what he had to say.
All right. As promised, it is time to welcome our guest, an old friend of mine, Howard Garrett, known as the Dirt Doctor to tons of Texas organic gardeners. He has a syndicated radio show heard throughout Texas and the environs. He joins us today through the kind auspices of K-Sky in Dallas to talk about the mosquito issue. Howard, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. Good to hear from you.
It's good to be heard from. Now, this is happening in many places all over the country where people are afraid of West Nile virus, and the municipalities have responded by spraying poisons over top of everybody. Now, Howard, back when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, I seem to remember stumbling across the statistic that when these aerial sprays come out, that well below 0.1%, maybe like 0.001% ever has the opportunity to even impact a target pest. Does that ring a bell with you?
Probably that or less, because the spray doesn't even get to the real problem, mosquitoes. It hits the tops of trees and the tops of houses and goes all over all kinds of hard surfaces. It kills a few of the adults that are flying around in the air, but the bulk of the problem is down in stagnant water and sewer lines and drainage lines, inside old tires and things like that, where the spray just simply doesn't contact the mosquitoes.
The one I'm always yelling at people about, and you know me, Howard, when I say I'm yelling at people, it's not just an expression, is I tell them very early in the spring, actually late winter, get up and check out your gutters, that is the unseen breeding ground for the mosquitoes that'll wind up biting you and perhaps giving you some illness in August.
Well, that's true. I think that's one of the main places where they get started. And the curious thing is that they're very easy to kill when they're in the water or in wet environments with BTI products. You can also kill them with various kinds of oils. But the most important part of it is to educate the people that they can do it also themselves at home. And we're trying to get the landscape industry into it. We're trying to get Boy Scouts. We're trying to get the churches. We're trying to get everybody around to think about getting on board this very simple program that we recommend that will actually control the mosquitoes.
As you and I know, you toss some of this naturally occurring stuff into stagnant water, and no mosquitoes can breed there for what, about a month?
About 30 days is what they say. It might last longer than that. One of the nice things about it is that the water can go dry and then re-wet, and they are still viable. You can even set up traps, which is what some of my entomologist friends and I have been scheming about lately, and that is to, in your bird baths at home, keep BT there on a regular basis, but also set up some additional containers that hold water. It can be old whiskey barrels. It can be pots. It can be anything that will hold water, and throw some grass clippings or something in it to actually set up a condition that will attract the Culex mosquito. In other words, we're setting up an attractant for them, and there'll be BT in that trap, and we can actually control them there even better. There are some commercial products on the market that use that same technology.
As an old Philadelphia boy, I like the aspect of revenge and kind of sucker punching some mosquitoes here. It's very appealing to me emotionally.
It'll really work, and you wouldn't have to set up very many. You could do it with some barrels or with some pots or with an old bucket or whatever, and just make sure you keep the BT applied, you know, every couple of weeks or 3 weeks or something, so you know it's fresh in there. And I think if we could get a lot of people doing that, we could really make a huge dent. My first step on mosquito control might surprise folks a little bit, and it is to clean up the trash. Have a very, very intense program for homeowners, for cities, for counties, for the state, for everybody. Because one day it finally dawned on me that if there's just pieces of plastic out laying around, old plastic bags or bottle caps or whatever, all of those things hold enough water to breed this Culex mosquito.
And we should remind people who are skittish about using anything, birds can drink from this water. They won't be harmed. Frogs and toads and salamanders can come and go from this water. They won't be harmed. There are secondary targets that do get knocked down unintentionally. If anybody out there enjoys the bite of a black fly, we apologize to them. BT will stop any fly. And I don't know about you, but I was astounded when I found out mosquitoes were in the fly family. Any biting fly that breeds in water will be stopped by BT. So it's not just mosquitoes. It's black flies. It's some varieties of those annoying gnats and midges that come after you. So, yeah, Howard, I can understand how in many communities, Texas, California, many southern states, this would be a year-round battle. But it also occurs to me that if you're taking care of standing water and you're doing prevention and you're paying attention, year round, maybe these mosquitoes don't really have a chance once we really start paying attention 24/7.
I think the program will work. And for people who want to get my weekly free stuff, all you got to do is just send me an email and I have your email address. You'll get our weekly free newsletter. And we'll continue to update everybody on our findings and our new ideas and techniques like the traps we talked about, and get everybody's suggestions as well. I love getting people to give me ideas that came from their gardens.
Exactly, exactly. I hadn't thought of the traps before you mentioned it. That will become part of my repertoire. On a good day, I might even credit you. All right, we've been talking to Howard Garrett, the Dirt Doctor, who is an organic broadcasting legend in Texas and the environs. He joined us from K-Sky in Dallas, and we will put a link to the Dirt Doctor up on our website when we air this interview. Howard, always a pleasure to speak with you. Great work you're doing on this mosquito problem. Keep it up.
Mike, you're the best. Talk to you soon.
Well, that sure was an interesting group of informative interviews now, wasn't it? Yes, it's Mike McGrath. I finally found a parking spot and made it into the studio. And I want to congratulate Alexis Landis and Marissa Nicosia for doing a fine job shepherding those interviews to your ears. Lots of fun topics in there, and I want to mention that especially for those of you who have poison ivy problems, you're in luck, because that's also the question of the week. The question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail with all of our patented poison ivy removal plan, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Don't forget, if you have a question, you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Al Banks. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar, You Bet Your Garden's internet illuminators. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our editor is Al Banks. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. And I am extremely sad to bid adieu to our ace production assistant, Marissa Nicosia, who moves on after this show. That's why Alexis Landis isn't in here with me to close things down. She's out in the hallway crying her eyes out. We will miss Marissa greatly. Once again, congratulations to Marissa and Alexis for doing a fine job on the show. I'm Mike McGrath, and I'll see you again next week. Holy matrimony, Batman! Can an August bride grow her own bouquet? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal a professional cut flower grower's secret for successful bridal blooms. Plus your fabulous phone calls.